Let's come forward a number of years. I was married 5 times in sobriety, for Christ's sake. I kept trying. I don't know. You don't know. I don't know. You know. Shit. Maybe this time. Okay, great. And I'll tell you something real interesting about learning to listen to the intuition. 4 of those 5 times, headed down the aisle, everything in me said, not a good idea. Not a good idea, Bob. Then I said, quiet. Shut up. I stood there looking good for the wedding. I had a friend of mine who used to be more honest. He introduced his girlfriend. He said, I want you to meet my future ex-wife. He knew he couldn't put one together, you know. Okay, at one point in recovery, the only time I went down the aisle and I didn't feel like I should run was after 2 years of dating and separate apartments and the whole thing, and just a really good relationship and a lot of good feelings and a lot of love. This is a good testimony as to day at a time is kind of important. So after 2 years, we finally decided to get married. So we got married in January 1973, January 6th. On February 7th, we found out she had cancer and was going to die. And on April 23rd, she passed away. Interestingly enough, it was through her death that started my nutritional consciousness from the people that we went to treating her, because she refused toxic treatment. And so we were forced to seek non-toxic treatments for cancer in this country and other countries, and that's where I began to get a lot of my information. Anyway, she passed away. Now, we come forward to last year at some point, or a year and a half ago, and the lady I was in a relationship with then had been sick for a while, physically ill, really ill. Which I got more, learned more about nutrition and healing with food and stuff through this period of time. And one day she came to me in the living room, she said to me, there's distance between us. You know? There's distance between us. Now, when you confront me, I always react real well immediately. My response was, I'm standing 3 feet in front of you. How the fuck can there be distance in between us? I mean, that's all I know. I get real defensive because I can't get in touch with my feelings immediately always, because sometimes I won't listen to my intuition and I don't know what my feelings are, and if confronted, I panic. And if I panic, I lock off from myself. So I'll tell people, talk to me tomorrow, which drives people, some people nuts, you know. I'll tell you how I feel tomorrow. So here she is saying, I feel distance. I've been hearing that bullshit from people that they feel distance from me because I was goddamn old enough to have a sand pail. Well, of course, it was true. Because I was distancing myself in my home to save my life. Okay? So it was a form of protection. So I said, what do you mean distance? I don't know how to do any more than I'm doing. You know, I've been fixing the food, I go to the drugstore, I get the medicine, I do the thing, I go here, I go to the health center, I do that. And she said, wait, stop, man. She said, that's custodial care. I can get a nurse in here to give me custodial care. You know, I'm talking about emotional distance. And I said, all right, let me go away and be quiet. I'll talk to you later. And went off in the other room. 5 minutes later, I'm back in the living room. I got tears streaming down my face. And I look at her and I said, you're right. You're absolutely right. There is distance between us. There is distance. And I said, and I'll tell you why. There's distance between us because the last time I was with somebody I really cared about and they got sick, they died. And there's a little guy who lives inside of me that when you got sick, he put on his running shoes and his little hat and he took off down the road because he ain't going to be here for a repeat performance. I said, so what you're getting from me in the way of emotional support is all I have to give. I have no more. If you need more, you're going to have to look to the therapist. You're going to have to look to your sponsor. You're going to have to look to your friends because it's not here for me to give you. Wow. Growth. 2 whole people in a room. One who has needs, the other one who can stand up and not have to want to crawl away and die because he can't fulfill them. I used to always think, if I couldn't give you what you wanted, something's wrong with me. Not true. I can only give you what I can give you, and there's nothing wrong with me. And there's also nothing wrong with you if you need more than I can give you. It's okay. It's all right. You know, we lock in and look to that one other person for goddamn everything, and no one other person can do everything. It is unrealistic and destined to fail. I mean, I finished a great ACA workshop for 8 weeks, and one of the focuses was secondary relationships and how important it is to have them, whether it's the guy at the checkout counter at the market, the girl at the dry cleaners, the guy that puts the gas in your car, your gardener, your mailman. All these people are relationships, and you got to start seeing them as relationships, acknowledging them as relationships, and understanding that each one of these people has something to give to you, and you have something to give to them when you encounter them throughout your life, and take that heat off of the primary relationship. Okay? So that you don't have to kill the people, you know, each other in the relationship. How good it felt to stand there and say, this is me, this is all there is, and it's okay. I don't have to want to die because I can't do it for you. I don't have to want to die. Now that to me is part of the process, part of the recovery. But 5 years before that, 5 years before the therapy, 5 years before a lot of the activities in my life, I was still out there. You wanted something? I didn't have it. Bye. I mean, plants could not live in my house. To give up till 5 years ago or 4 years ago, to give me a plant was to sentence it to death. Because they require water on a regular basis. I could not water me on a regular basis 5 years ago. I can't water a goddamn plant on a regular basis. And plants would die. And I hated it when people gave me plants because I knew it was going to die. It had no hope. Today, all my plants live. Not true. One just died. I'm taking it back. I just bought it a few days ago. It's no longer me. They sold me a faulty plant. And I know that now, you see. And I don't have to be guilty about walking in with my plants and my little ticket and staying here. Which, by the way, I also couldn't have done 6 years ago. And I can take it back calmly. Or if I had done it 6 years ago, I would have gone in with such an expression on my face, right, that nobody would have wanted to deal with me. My ears would have been red. My neck would have been big. I would have looked like I was looking when I was taking off both ends of a drug deal with that kind of homicidal expression on my face with the plant and the receipt and wonder why people responded to me so badly. Yeah? Because they immediately get defensive. What do you want? What the fuck do you think I want? It's dead, asshole. You're blind? You know, and we would have gone on from there. Negotiations across the counter at the nursery, right? That's another thing about, since I've changed a lot of these things in my life, I woke up and everything isn't okay anymore. And I also will now ask questions. And when I was asleep under the chemicals that I was eating, I never came, you know, I just, oh, okay, you know? And part of getting to love yourself is, God, you know, part of the process, oh, Jesus, I ate so much fucking cold food in restaurants because I couldn't say anything. And you know what's worse than my not being able to say anything? If my dinner partner sent their food back, I wanted to die. I couldn't stand people being around anybody with self-esteem because they embarrassed me. I remember the first time I went to a sushi bar. I'd never been there before, and neither had my friend. My friend, unfortunately, had a lot of self-esteem. He started at one end of the case. The restaurant's full of people. I mean, he's leaning over people to do this, right? He started at one end of the goddamn case and went from one end to the other asking what every fucking thing in the case was and how it tasted and would he like it. Well, what's that? An octopus? Or you cook it? You don't? What's it taste like? Oh. Chewy? Yeah? What's this? I'm back against the wall, you know. See? But I did learn a lot about sushi that I wouldn't have learned otherwise. I would have sat there and ordered stuff I hated and ate it and looked good in the process. There's a story I tell about after a total, absolute, complete surrender to God in incredible desperation, a person who has failed English ever since the fourth grade,
am a phonetic speller, and they threw me out of high school in the 10th grade, became a writer. So surrender tonight, and your life will change tomorrow. Of course, the very next day after I surrendered, I broke my back. We'll get into that maybe later, maybe tomorrow, which is a good thing. See, you understand, control freaks have to interpret everything. That's how we wipe ourselves out. Oh, that's good. That's bad. That's good. That's bad. Everybody's got to be in this little box. That's okay. That's bad. Right? There's a story about that I love. I'll tell it. It's about a little village up in Europe, in the mountains. And this guy had this incredibly magnificent white horse. And the king came to this guy's little farm to buy his white horse. He said, I want to buy the horse. And the guy says, oh, God, I can't sell him. You know? I can't sell him. He's been with us too long. And he's a poor little farmer. So the king says, okay, and rides away. And that night, the horse ran away. And all the villagers rushed out to this guy's farm and said, oh, what a terrible thing. You should have sold the horse. You didn't sell the horse. Now the horse has run away. You have no horse, no money. That's bad. That's a terrible thing. The little farmer said, oh, I don't know if that's bad. I just know that I didn't sell the horse and he's gone. 3 days later, the horse returns and he brings 6 other horses back with him. Now all the villagers rush back out to this guy's farm and say, wow, you were right. It wasn't a bad thing. He came back and he brought 6 other horses with him. It's a good thing. So the farmer says, I don't know that it's a good thing, but I do know he's back, and I do know he brought 6 horses with him. In the weeks that followed, his son was riding the horses, his only son, to try and break them for saddles so they could sell them as saddle horses. And his son was thrown off one of the horses and broke both of his legs. Again, the villagers rush out and say, wow, you were right. It wasn't a good thing that he brought the horses back. It was a terrible thing. Now your only son, the only help you have, has both his legs broken. What a terrible thing. The old farmer says, geez, I don't know that it's a terrible thing. I do know my son has both of his legs broken. In the weeks that followed, this little tiny country went to war with a country 100 times its size, and to be sent to the front to fight was guaranteed death. And the army came through the countryside and through the small villages, and they took every able-bodied young man to take him to the front to die. But they couldn't take the farmer's son because both of his legs were broken. And once again, the villagers rushed out to his farm. And they said, God, you're right. It wasn't a bad thing that he got his legs broken. It was a good thing. Because he doesn't have to go off and die. And the farmer says, well, I don't know that it's a good thing, but I do know that he doesn't have to go and die. And the story goes on and on and on. And the reality is, that's life. Does not need interpretation or classification. Only people who need to control, none of us, I'm sure, but find it necessary to get things in their box. That's good. That's bad. So when I broke my back, I said, my mind said, that's bad. This is terrible. I've been telling you for 5 years in recovery, don't surrender to God. You surrendered last night. Here you are in the emergency hospital with a broken back. I told you. This little guy inside here, who I had not really heard before in my sobriety at that point, said to my mind, why don't you shut up? Now I find myself 5 years sober in the position of a moderator here. I've got voices here and voices here. Now I must decide which voices to listen to. The decision was based on listening to these voices for years. It destroyed me. Having never heard this one before, I thought I would listen to it and decide that maybe breaking my back, being in the emergency hospital, was not a bad deal. So I just let it go at that. And as a result of that, I became a writer. Okay. This is just basic stuff, guys. Basic, God is in charge. I go to voc rehab. I decide, okay, breaking my back is a good thing. I don't know it's a bad thing, so it's a good thing. It's God, my life. What I decided was this. My life was in perfect order, absolute divine spiritual order, with my broken back, even though it didn't make sense to me. And I decided I would just not think about it, and I would do what was put in front to me to do. So I went to voc rehab and applied for vocational rehabilitation, went and got my disability insurance, got fitted with all the braces and crap I had to wear on my back, and I had terrible times at voc rehab, bad times at voc rehab, because I kept giving me aptitude tests and I kept coming out different things. See? And they thought I was running a goddamn game on them, you know, and I didn't understand. You know, I kept trying to explain to them, I'm answering the questions honestly. One day I like the outdoors, the next day I don't like the outdoors. You know, what the hell do you want me to say? You know? So, one day I should be a forest ranger, and the next day I should be a goddamn plumber, you know, but I mean, it's like I would answer how I felt that day. That's what I would put down. I didn't even know what I was doing, but I knew they were pissed off. 6 months go by, we can't come to terms, Voc Rehab and me. They can't get me to do anything they want me to do, because they want me basically to become a social worker. They want to get me a high school equivalency test, send me back to UCLA, get a bachelor's degree in psychology, and become a social worker and help people because I'm in the recovery programs, right? And I'm saying to the Voc Rehab counselor, the Board of Criminal Psychiatry of the state of California says I'm a homicidal social psychopath. With a complete inability to function in a society in a free world or incarcerated that contains people without reacting to that society with extreme violence. I have never seen those as requisites for social work, you know. And in case, darling, you're missing the point, I goddamn don't like people, okay? So we went around like this for 6 months. One night I'm sitting home reading a TV guide, and there's an ad in there about would you like to be a writer. And this little guy in here says, yeah. Let's try that. My mind, of course, immediately was supportive. Just watch yourself when you think about trying any new thing. The mind will hook in and grind you up. Drive a new route to work Monday. Your mind will start driving you nuts over it now. I can't go. You go that way, you get... No, shit, you can't make the signal on third if you do that. The railroad tracks are there. Well, if we go an extra mile of freeway, we can't do that. The mind don't want nothing new. It wants comfort, familiarity, so it can think. If you... if you drive a new route, you must concentrate on where you are. You can't think. It can't stand that. It wants you to think, right? So my little intuitive person says, let's do that. Mine says, you dummy. You know, you fucking write what? You can't even write a letter. Yeah. I go to Voc Rehab, give my counselor the ad. She gets hysterical, almost falls out of her wheelchair, laughing, right? She thinks it's really funny because she's got my jacket in front of me. She knows everything about me. She knows I'm a phonetic speller. She knows I failed English ever since the fourth grade. She knows they threw me out of high school. She knows, right? It's a joke to her. God, however, in his infinite wisdom, had outsmarted the bureaucracy of the state of California. Because I had been on their roll for 6 months. I had been on since July. This is now December. They had placed everybody who had come in October. Okay? I was like the black mark of the Van Nuys Office of Vocational Rehabilitation. This guy would have paid for basket weaving for me, okay? Just to get me the hell off the books, right? So he said, pay for the course. Pay for the course. So I get my books from the course, and so now I start to write. First story I try to write is a short story. Terrible. I want you to know, really bad. But I'm reading my books while I'm doing it, and the books say, critical for a first-time writer to write for a medium that he's familiar with. I thought, oh, well, shit, I never read anything in my life, you know? But I vlogged a lot of hours in front of the television set, so I'll do a television story. So I sat down, I tried to write a story for Bonanza. Not good. The idea was very good. I sold the idea a year later and wrote it as a Virginian, but the execution of it left a lot to be desired. I mean, I even wrote in the dialect, you know, for the Chinese cook. We don't say lice, you fucking gleek plick, you know. I just... I thought perhaps they had a sense of humor. So I keep reading my books and they say not only should you write for a medium you're familiar with, but you should write, it's essential you write about something you're familiar with. I thought, oh, God, I never was in the old West. What do I know about? I thought, crime. So I started watching the crime shows on TV. And I picked out one I liked. And I thought, well, what haven't I seen as a story? And I thought, I've never seen a really good story about a righteous paper hanger. I mean, a check passer of printed payroll checks. And having done a year for cashing some $80,000 worth of payroll checks, I felt qualified to write the beginning, the middle, and the end. I had a whole story. So I sat down and I began to write this story. I'm just going through, you know, life is just really a matter of going through the open doors. Okay? It's really that simple. Somehow we begin to think in the process and get lost in the hallway. But usually it's just going through the open doors. Because I'm sitting, I'm working on this little story, and one night a friend of mine is bringing me home from a meeting, and I'm broke, I've been bankrupt in the courts, I'm, you know, don't have an automobile, 5 years sober. You know, my life is not exactly a bed of roses, you know, but I'm okay, I'm writing my little story. And this guy brings me home from a meeting, and I never knew what people did for a living. I wouldn't let people tell me. I never wanted to know, because I knew I'd use it, right? Just don't tell me. I don't want to know. This guy brings me home from a meeting. He says, what are you doing? I said, I'm trying to write a story for television, right? He says, oh, yeah, great. That's what I do. I said, what? He says, I write for TV. I said, you're putting me on. He says, no, when you get done with your story, let me read it. You know, maybe I can give you some pointers. So I finish the story, and I give it to him. He suggests a dozen changes in it. Six of the suggestions I liked, and I made those changes. The other six I hated, so I ignored them. Which I later found out is creative choice, a matter of choice. Then he says to me, look, do you want to get it typed up, you know, before you send it in to Ironsides? And I said, yeah, I think I need to. You know, I don't think anybody at Universal knows that dead is spelled D-E-D, you know. and a character should be spelled with a K, but... Do it the best you can. They said, well, look, there's a girl on a program who does my typing for me when she gets home from work. Why don't we give it to her and let her type it up? I said, okay, great. Might as well have, you know, somebody on the program make the money. So about 3 days go by while I'm insane trying to figure out what I'm going to do with the story and get it to Universal and, you know, how I'm going to, you know, get past the guards at the gate and whether you use a gun or you don't or, you know. Just quietly sitting at home thinking, you know. My problems are never as scary as my solutions to my problems. My solutions are absolutely terrorizing. The problem's goddamn school kid stuff. The solution gets... After 3 days, this girl calls me up, says, I just finished reading the story you wrote, and she said, I think it's very good. She said, did Jim tell you where I work? I said, no, why? She said, well, I'm secretary to the associate producer on Ironsides. I thought maybe you'd like me to take it in for you. Life is go through the open doors. I'll take it a couple beats further. She gives it to them. They like it. They buy it. Now I got to go meet with the producer about doing the script. And Jim, my writer friend, says to me, okay, now look, and he forgot how literal I am, a very literal person. He says to me, look, they're going to ask you if you ever wrote a script before. He said, tell them no. Tell them, but you'll do a better job for them than their goddamn hacks at the studio because it's more important to you than it is to them. And they're only going to pay you $2,600 for the script, and they piss that much away on a mistake on every show. Next day, I'm at Universal Studios. In the elevator, riding up in the Black Tower, scared to death. Saying to God, if you don't get off this elevator with me, I am in more trouble than I have been in since I got sober, right? So I get off, and I sit down, and I go in this guy's office, and I'm dealing with, I don't know, but I'm dealing with one of the real fucking maniacs in the business, right? A guy who, if you cross him, will spend days working to destroy your career. That kind of mentality, right? And I'll be a son of a bitch. He said exactly to me what Jim said he'd say to me, in the exact words. Have you ever written a script before? So I said to him exactly what Jim said to me. I said, no, I haven't, but I'll do a better job for you than your hacks here at the studio because it's more important to me than it is to them, and you're only going to pay me $2,600, and you piss that much away on a mistake on every show. God protects small children. What followed was the longest 5 seconds of my life. And then he started to laugh, right? Because nobody had ever talked to him like this. No one had even come close to talking to him like this. So I said, go home and write me the goddamn script. Well, anyway, I go home, I write the script. They love the script. Universal wanted to put me in a contract. It was good. I wrote him a good script. I wrote a really good script. I'll give myself credit for it. So now the show, and they were great. They let me hang out with the director for the whole filming of it, and the whole thing. It was all done, all over. And they said, let's do another one. Go home, think of an idea, come back Wednesday, we'll talk. So I go home, think of an idea. Going to do another show. I'm going to do a second script. I mean, this is really exciting. I sit down at home to think of an idea. My mind says to me, hear about those guys that write one book? You just wrote your one script. And I tried to think of an idea for a crime show. 11 years of my life was devoted to it, right? I can't come up with a goddamn idea. I'm watching television at night, late night, thinking maybe I can steal a fucking idea and take it in, and nothing. I cannot come up with an idea. My mind is silent. The son of a bitch talks from morning till night, all day long, and when I turn to it one time, right? One time I say to it, huh? A little help. Nothing. It goes into a meditative state. By this point in my recovery, I've learned one critical policy. Show up no matter what. Having no story idea, knowing I'm going to be ridiculed and embarrassed, I showed up anyway. And I'm sitting in this guy's office, and I'm terrorized. And he says to me, well, what are we going to do? You got any ideas? And I go, I was home, and I was given some thought to, he says, never mind, look, he says, wait a minute, he says, I got an idea. He said, we've been on the show, on the air 2 years now. He said, we're one of the top shows in the country. We have a massive viewing audience. And he said, we have some responsibilities to this viewing audience to do some shows that have some meaning. He said, I would like to do a show about upper middle class teenagers and drug addiction. I'm saying in my mind, you fucking halfwit. You know, you're the addict, for Christ's sake. Why couldn't you think of that one? You know, I had to come in here to get this goddamn idea, you know. So I say to this guy in my enthusiasm, oh, yeah, great. Well, we should talk about them. And he said, whoa, wait, Jesus, how do you know so much? Caught, I look him in the eye and say, well, I am a drug addict and an alcoholic, and I have been recovered in the programs of NA and AA for 5 years. He says, oh, that's great. We talked for a couple minutes more. He said, it won't offend you, will you? Will it if we ask for a technical advisor to come in on the show? I said, no, that's cool. The technical advisor turned out to be a narcotics officer from the Los Angeles Police Force in the San Fernando Valley, who I had taken a shot at in 1960. He said, I'm surprised. We stand in the office, we're introduced to each other, right? And nobody wants to let out what's going on here, right? It's a very strange energy in this office at the studio. Because he's still armed and I'm not, you know. He said to me, I'm surprised to see you free. I said, I'm surprised to see you alive. And that was all we had to say to each other for the whole show. That was, you know. But again, man, it was go through the open doors, you know, and it went like that. It went like that. The only time I got fucked up was here a couple of years ago because I didn't pay any attention to my intuition and I stayed at the wall. And I've just turned, moved, and changed my whole life, upheaved everything. And it's all fine now. I mean, I couldn't buy a job in that town last year, not buy one. I moved to Santa Fe 4 weeks ago, and I've done more work, paid work for TV. And my mind told me for years, you can't leave town. You must be close to the industry. If you leave town, they'll forget about you. They won't know who you are. And I've been having to come in from Santa Fe to talk to them because now suddenly I'm wonderful, right? So I'm out of fucking town and the work is pouring in, but I'm where I'm supposed to be. I went on for a few years as a writer. I've been doing it ever since, but at one point after I've been writing about 14 years, and this was a real heavy one for me. A friend of mine came to visit me to the studio. This guy was another one of those. Not raised by dysfunctional parents. Addicted, chemically addicted, but not raised by dysfunctional parents. Has a great sense of self. You know? He's okay as is. He doesn't know he's not. Nobody ever taught him that. So, he comes to the studio one day to visit me. Now, he's another one of these problem people to be with publicly because he's not cool. He's not cool. I get him in the studio. He's never been to a studio. He goes nuts. He goes nuts. I'm walking him across the lot to my office, and it's like, oh, God, wow, that's what's her name, man. She looks better in public, in person than on TV. Jesus, what's her name? I love her show. It's great. You know, I mean, you can hear him from four blocks on the lot, right? This is not quietly whispered in my ear. This is, right? I mean, he was like that with everything. He said, oh, shit, that building isn't real. It is, man. This is far out. They just popped that thing up. That's great. What do you know? He said, yeah, I used to do that with my life, you know. And it's like, prop something up, put it out there, you know. Here's me. So I had to get him off the street, so we're going to do this special effects gag on the show. Very complicated, intricate kind of gag where we had an automobile crash into a light store, a light fixture store. And what makes it a complicated stunt is as the car proceeds through the store, the lights have to explode in a timing with the explosives are set in all the lights and they got to go off at the same time the car moves through the store. It works, you're heroes. It doesn't work, you just blew $50,000 in goddamn drain, right? So I take him out to watch the stunt and it goes off perfect. I mean, it was spectacular. Flying fucking glass, exploding lamps, the car, everything was, couldn't have been better. All the cameras worked, everything was great. And he walks up to the special effects guy after it's over. He says, how the hell did you do that? I thought, oh, how can he do this? How can he fucking ask him? You know? Much to my amazement, the guy started to tell him. And he walked him through and showed him. Now I knew how it was done. See, I never knew because I never asked. I never knew because I never asked. Because if I ask you a question, I somehow have absolutely thoroughly convinced myself if I ask you a question that I don't know something, it will give away that something's wrong with me and that I'm not enough. So I don't ask questions. I stand there in silence, in ignorance, pretend, act as if, but I won't let you see that there's something I don't know. Because I think you're going to finish me off. So I figure now I got to get him off the soundstage. I'll take him to the commissary, right? I get him in the commissary. The guys from MASH are having lunch. It's his favorite show. Forget it. I mean, I want to get under the fucking table, you know? I mean, he's going to get autographs. Now he loves this guy. He remembers this episode, that episode. I mean, he just, I'm looking for a flower pot to hide in, right? About 5 hours later, I've got him, you know, in total, I get him off the lot, and I walk back to my office, sit down in my office. You know how every now and then you have those little, very unpleasant moments of awareness? It dawned on me that this friend had just had more fun with my career in 5 hours than I had had in 14 years. You see, because I lived in fear in my career that I would be found out. Somehow it was a mistake that I was succeeding. I used to drive in the studio knowing my parking space would be gone and that it was over. I had been fired. Terrified. I couldn't even accept praise for my work. Didn't know how. Didn't know how. See, I'd never seen anybody do it. I didn't understand it was okay. I didn't know how. One time I wrote an episode for Starsky and Hutch in 4 days. They were desperate for the script. I wrote the script in 4 days, got on a plane and went to Hawaii. I didn't even want to be around when they read it, right? I'm over in Hawaii about 3 days and a letter comes at this place, at this gal's place where I was staying. We come home from the beach, open the mailbox, and here's this letter from the producers at 20th Century Fox. And I'm like any good compulsive, obsessive personality, I'm reading it, you know, through the envelope. And I know what it says. I know it says, "This is the worst piece of crap we have ever read in our lives. Not only will you never write for this show again, you will never write for any show as long as you live if we have anything to do about it." The lady with me, not understanding the complexities of the situation, said, "Why don't you open it?" So I opened it. The letter said, in essence, "We wanted to sit down and take the time to drop you a short note to thank you for the script that we just finished reading. It is one of the two finest scripts that has ever been written for this show since it's on the air. We want to thank you for the love and the caring and the tenderness that went into it. We are not going to rush it to production like originally planned. We will wait for you to return to the mainland to make some changes that need to be changed, some minor ones, and then we will produce it with the care and treatment that it deserves." You know what I said? "At least they aren't pissed off." The best I could do. That's the best I could do. You know? And you know what's sad about that? I should have been able to jump straight up in the air like a Toyota ad in the driveway and scream at the top of my lungs, "I am a good writer. And other people know it also." But I couldn't do that. I didn't know how. See? And it all here, throughout the rest, you know, even tomorrow morning, everything is going to come back to not knowing how. Not having the tools, not knowing the tools exist, or if you have the tools, not knowing how to use them because you've never seen them used. I don't know how. I only know how to do what I was taught, and most of it is destructive. Talking about unlearning old behavior and learning new. That's what it's all about. That's what it's all about. Anyhow, it's what is the script is about? It was the first time I risked writing about someone you love dying. It was the first time since Taylor had died that I took the chance to sit down to write about the experience. And so I wrote about his girlfriend getting injured and death being imminent. And that was the story, their relationship and what went on between them while she's preparing herself to die. That was what it was about. And it was good. It was really good. Yeah. Oh God. Well, I think we need. What time is the meeting? I don't have a thing. Oh, okay. Then we should put a lid on this one somehow. Well, this one is again another one of these controversial statements. Let's close with it. The most important person. See, you know, everybody always says, "Oh, the newcomer is the most important person in the room." I guess that's an okay philosophy if you view the recovery programs to be like a coal furnace that needs new lumps of coal to keep it going. Otherwise, if that's not how you choose to view the recovery programs, then the most important person, at least here at this retreat, is in your chair. There's nobody more important. Nobody more important. Because again, it's all going to come back to what you can. I can't do for you what I can't do for myself. I can't give to you things I can't give to me. I can't let you have and express and experience the feelings in you that I can't let me have and express. Because I don't understand them and they scare me and I got to stop you. So the most important person, at least here, if you want anything to focus on for tonight, the most important person here is you. You. That's it. God bless you. Okay.
That's interesting. A couple of things. I was listening to the announcements, which is interesting. New groups are always great because usually they're started because everybody's pissed off in another group, which I think, which is how all new groups start or need, and give me support. But I was interested in listening to Becky talk about the house, because I think at any time, man, that we can support any environment that's supportive to recovery, and we don't do it. You know, because if you're not doing that, what are you doing? You know, and if you're not supporting an environment that's conducive to recovery and an environment that's supporting recovery, you know, you might want to ask yourself, why not? Because oftentimes I can go out and support an environment that's conducive to recovery and thereby support my own recovery. You know, it's a little old thing. And it's no joke, you know, all these years they've been saying, you know, what you put out, you get back. Sure, sometimes it's a big sack. I got to sit down and write the fucking check, put it in the mail, and the stamp's 20. You know, I mean, I know. I have the same mind. I wake up with it every morning. You know, and to help, it's not designed, you know. My mind's never met anybody that wanted to help that didn't want something from. And like my best friend says, the minute he wants something from somebody, his personality changes. He suddenly becomes a new person. I was so funny because it made me think of another thing he said one time. We were talking about acceptance, you know, need of in relationships, the need for control, you know, and letting people be who they are. And one time he called me on the phone, he said, I'm just so goddamn sick and tired of running into women in the supermarket and saying, oh, God, come with me and you're going to love the woman I'm going to turn you into, you know. I like you as you are. There's just a few things I want to change. But once I get you in shape, you'll be okay. And the thing about not being able to get money for eating disorders is fascinating. You know, it's really fascinating because I was just in Pearl Harbor here a month ago. Which is a real aggressive military rehab. I mean, these guys there are great, you know, because it's a heavyweight situation anyway, because it's the Marines and the Navy mixed in the same base. So they're dealing with all these personalities. And I was talking with some of the officers there, all of whom are recovered themselves. Some of these guys are Marine pilots, you know, who are really gentle souls. I like to drop napalm and shit, you know. And we were talking, and you know what the number one problem in the military is? Food. Eating disorder. Not alcohol and not drugs. So despite, you know, all the furor over the drug addiction in the service, which, by the way, and I don't mean to, and for one second, diminish food as a serious and eating disorder is a serious problem, but I can definitely understand when we have a military that is loaded with nuclear arms that we are focusing on drug addiction first. That makes me feel better too, you know, because I know the great ideas that can be had when you're shooting morphine, you know. Sitting around in a fucking missile carrier, you know, saying, oh, well, what the hell, you know. Russia never wanted the Siberian Strait anyway, you know. And it's not too hard to get two or three people who are using the same drug to agree. My hope in the military has always been is that they're always using different stuff, you know, because you never can get a heroin addict and a speed freak to agree on anything, so. It is. My experience has been, it is. I've talked with too many guys who are getting loaded. Never mind, it's not important. It makes me nervous, actually. But I never used to get nervous, I never used to care. See, I never used to care. You know, that's the thing. Until I started to deal with my feelings, I never cared. And I never cared about any of it. You know, people say, oh, God, there's too many nuclear weapons. I didn't care. Didn't affect me. I had no consciousness. I had no consciousness that this was a society. I had no consciousness that I was a part of it. I had no consciousness that, you know, that somehow it's what I do counts. You know, it is this guy I spent some time with a couple months ago. One of the things he said is, a couple of things he said are beautiful, you know, and he ended anything, any statement he made with God bless you, you know, and he says it in a way that just makes you feel warm all over. And he said that a couple of things that you need to understand at the human level. And one is that all of life is nothing but relationships. That is all it is relationships. But it's not just our relationship with our primary relationship, our mate. It is our relationship with everybody, but not just everybody. It is also our relationship to animals and to plants and to the environment and to water and to everything here. Life is but the relationship. And that all human pain comes from the illusion of separation. And that there is no separation. It is only an illusion. It's just an illusion that we're separated from God, or that we're separated from each other, or that we're separated from the energy of life. It's no more than an illusion. And that's the human pain. And that's our suffering. Yeah. Yes. I mean, the minute he said that, you know how sometimes you hear a truth, and it just, your insides just kind of flip over like a pancake, you know? Like, oh, yes, relationships, you know? And it's true. It's true. I find if I go out in a day and I concentrate on my relationship, since I've heard this, to everything, but people, whether it's the waitress where I have lunch, or the gal at the bank, or the guy in the parking lot, or the ticket seller at the movie theater, or the popcorn seller at the movie theater, or whoever it is, if I concentrate on these relationships, if I just take a second to make a connection. If they can, you can't always, because a lot of people aren't home. You know, it's, you know, but at least today I know that it's them that's not home. I used to think that expression was created by me, that somehow I was responsible for this look they had on their face. Now I can approach people in a state of that sense of relationship. And if they're not there, they're not there. And I don't have to want to go out and kill myself because of it, you know. So if you have nothing to do someday, you might want to just take a day and see how, what your relationship's like to everything. Animals, plants, people, your environment, your own environment, the one in which you live. Yeah? What's your relationship like to it? Is it home? Are you comfortable there? Is it safe? Is it nice? Can you do something to make it better? You know, can you throw stuff out? Is it time to unload? Is it time to lighten up, simplify, you know, get rid of the dead weight, you know, the dishes that are only for the company? Maybe it's time to, you know, put them on the table. Something wrong with that attitude, you know. If you're trying to live a spiritual program, you have dishes that are only for the company. Hate to tell you, that's not a real heavy spiritual motivated philosophy. The family isn't good enough to eat off of them, but we will have people in the house soon who are. That's like, you know, a lot of people grew up in houses with furniture you can't sit on, you know. And you wonder why you have compulsive disorders, you know. I know it's a chair, but you can't sit in it. It's for company. It's for important people. Somebody said they wanted me to tell a story about the bear, a couple of stories, and one about Drop the Rock. I'm trying to remember it. I you know. See, I find for me, you know, it's like a lot of things come into my life, and they have real impact. And like when I first heard the Drop the Rock story, it was like, oh, you know, bells and lights and alarms and whistles and all this. And I was like, wow, God, what a great story. And it's now probably 8 years later. And I can't really recall it. I may get it put together before I'm done, but it's like I believe that's life. things come and go, and they have real meaning and impact. And most of my pain in my life has come from with people, jobs, living situations, everything. I either won't let stuff out when it's time for it to go, or I'm trying to drag stuff in before it's time for it to come. And so I live in that constant state of that frustration, never understanding that apparently, as I'm starting to see it, the spiritualness of life is a flow. It's a flow. It's not a, here, this is yours. It's not mine. It's not mine. Everything I have is passing through, you know? And if I understand that, it takes such anxiety out of my life, you know? It's like, and by the way, you know, I know people that spend a lot of time, you know, they lock everything up. And, like, the thing about Santa Fe I love is I have heard one fucking car alarm in a month, and it was on a California car. You know? Okay? Because eventually, if you reach a point, not that I don't lock my doors and not that I don't lock my car, you know, but I don't have to have it wired with a $3,000 alarm system that's going to electrocute some poor son of a bitch who tried to rest for a minute, you know, leaned against my car and died in the parking lot, you know. So, but it's like, in this process, for me and the people that I'm close to, at least that you know, we've hung out together for a lot of years off and on, or paths have continued to cross off and on, we all eventually reach that point where the decision must be made about God. Either he is or he isn't. He is or he isn't. She is or she isn't. It is or it isn't. Whatever phraseology you're comfortable with, their power is either there or it's not. And if it's there, if there is a God, then that God is all-powerful, all-present, and all-loving. Conditionless. Then if he's all-powerful, all-present, all-loving, and it's conditionless, what are you worried about? Are you worried about? I mean, why? And what is it that you're trying to save or hang on to or protect? You know, it's like I'm a firm supporter and absolute believer in that we are possessed by our possessions. Absolutely. You're possessed by your possessions. It's another thing I love about Santa Fe. It's the only community I've ever been. The doctor put it this way last week, and I loved it when he said it. It's true. It's the only community left in the world where status is living on a dirt road. You know? I mean, it's just, it's incredible to see a change. You know, there's a couple of bumper stickers I've seen there which absolutely have touched my heart. And they say, live simply so that others may simply live. Okay? What else sends you home and make you look in the clothes closet? Shit, I went through a down the Claire Foundation. Here, guys. You know, and I have some more stuff in the car. You know, here, I don't need it. It's the, you know, it's stuff I can't use. I'm not using. I don't need it. Let me get rid of it because it's weighing me down. Because then, you know, I at least reached a point where I believe with most things are passing through my life. So I usually am not concerned about things being stolen. Nothing has ever been stolen from me since I made that decision in recovery 12 years ago. Nothing. And if it has, it has been returned, and the person stealing it has gone to jail. I mean, their retribution has been so quick. One guy got to the bus station where he was arrested. Another guy never got out of the garage in the apartment building. His car wouldn't start. And fortunately, he was a drug addict, and a dumb son of a bitch stayed and tried to push it out, you know. I mean, we're so fucking smart, it's a killer, right? Alarm's going off all over the goddamn apartment building, and this fool's trying to push his car out of the garage, you know. Sheriff's arrived by parachute from 17 directions, you know.
He's probably still in jail. And I got my T-roof and, you know, hubcaps back. But it's like, the absence of faith, I create an immense amount of anxiety and fear in my life. And that's just that simple. It's that trade-off. I've heard for years, you can't be in faith and fear at the same time. You know what? It's true. Yeah? You can't be in faith and fear at the same time. You cannot. It's like for people who want to try and quit smoking, you know, they always say, oh, well, God, you know, I tried, but I get so obsessed. I want a cigarette. That's all I can think about is I want a cigarette. Let me disclose to you a secret that the mind would really hate for you to know. Despite all the noise it makes and all the energy it puts out, and how it exhausts you and drives you crazy and sends you to the point of tears and just really beats you to death, it can only hold one thought at a time. It can only hold one thought at a time. So, the thing I learned, which astounded me, is that I am not responsible for the first thought that comes to my mind. I am not responsible. I have no control over the first thought that comes to my mind. It whips in there, man, like a rocket, you know? And it can be absolute madness. The thought can be insanity. I mean, raging lunacy. What I do have control over is whether I choose to entertain the thought. Now, I can spend the rest of the day with it, and just grind myself into the ground. You can see people when they come in meetings who have been thinking all day. They're shorter. You know? You just see, you know. Or I can sort of like a wrestler with a head hold on his partner, you know, just kind of take my mind and just turn it over to another thought. Yeah? Because the mind loves to just sort of roam uncontrolled through your life. And if it comes to God, the mind will click off. It just kind of goes into never-never land, the void. And if you don't think that's true, stop and think about the morning reading you do. If you read a day at a time or a daily word or any of those things, I bet with 97% of the people in this room, 30 seconds after you've read it, I can quiz you and you can't tell me what it said. You no more know what the thought for the day is by the time you exit the room than you did before you read it. Because the mind refused to stick around to read it. You ever notice how you pick the book up to read something good, something godlike, something spiritual, something beneficial, and the mind just sort of goes away? It's like, you know, and you're staring at this page and there's nothing happening. There's no exchange here, you know. It must be forced. See? It's got to be forced. Now, I don't know if it gets better. Yes, it gets better. I mean, I'm at this point now, I'm down to really four voices that I have to deal with. To those of you who are not from a dysfunctional home, that may not represent hope. To those of you who are from a dysfunctional home, it represents a miracle. Because four voices is a lot better than the 13 to 30 that I lived with the first 10 years of recovery. You know, it's a terror living with all those voices in your head. Because another reason it's a terror is because people don't talk about it at meetings, and that's sad because they're all sitting listening to the same thing. You know, I mean, if we could pipe into the mind energy in a meeting, it would be incredible. It would be like, you know. And everybody's just sitting there sort of at the meeting. Yeah. Like there's nothing going on, and they're planning their death and the rest of their life and somebody else's death and their financial disaster and everything else, you know, and their poverty, and they're going to be a dishwasher and their job, you know, all that's going on. They're just kind of, you know, just, nothing's happening. So four voices is kind of pleasant because even though mornings can still be a terror, I'll talk about mornings for a minute, although a lot of people know that I do that a lot. I talk about it a lot because mornings are just, my mind chooses the morning because that's my most vulnerable time. Upon awakening, I'm still, you know, a little off center and just kind of disoriented. You know, I just sort of open an eye and my mind is there waiting. At least that's how it feels to me. You know, I've always felt it's like it stayed up all night, you know. I used to use a description of a sign as like waking up and seeing this vulture sitting on the headboard looking down at you, you know. And it's still kind of that way, saying, "Ah, oh, good morning, I'm glad you're awake. I want to talk to you." First thing I want you to know is that you didn't get enough sleep. Doesn't matter, you've had 13 hours, you know. That's beside the point. Whatever it is, it's not enough, right? And then it will now tell me what kind of a bad day I'm going to have because I haven't had enough sleep. Well, you probably shouldn't go to work today because you're really tired, you know, and it's just best if you don't. But then, of course, if you don't, you're probably going to lose your job, so you have to go in. Of course, if you go in as tired as you are, you're going to screw up, and if you screw up, you're going to lose your job, you know. And now that you've gone in and screwed up and lost your job, what are you going to do? Because you only have about enough money to sustain you 6 weeks. So in 6 weeks, you're broke on your ass, you know. Oh, yeah, and by the way, that bump just below your knee is bone cancer. And how are you going to handle that, you know? Are you going to go to meetings and talk about it, or are you just going to be chicken shit and stay home and rot to death, you know? So you've been awake full 5 seconds here, right? You're unemployed, broke, and dying of cancer, all right? And then people wonder why you don't bound out of bed joyously to greet the goddamn day, you know? I remember when I was first sober, this guy and I shared an apartment. We couldn't even talk to each other in the morning. You know, we had a few months, we come out with this horrible expressions on our face, you know, cigarette in hand, just stand in the kitchen and watch the coffee perk, you know. And we learned not to speak because it would wind up in a huge, fuck you, man, you know. Because I'm all right, dying, sick, broke, you know, I don't need this asshole of my life telling me something, you know. So I don't greet the day with this sense of joy and wonder about life and God and, you know, and now, but I have a choice with all that when it starts. I can get caught up in it. I can give it validation, you know. Oh yeah, man. I say, oh yeah, you're right. It's never right. Forget it. It is never right. The mind is designed to be a tool. They said biblically, right? Thousands of years ago, it is an excellent servant and a terrible master. Meaning, it has nothing to do with deciding your life. It's there to add up the checkbook. And it hates that. Hear the silence? Huh? Mine's going, hey, fuck you, man. I'm here to run things. Yeah. No, you're not. You're there to determine whether the signal is red or green. You know? I'll let this decide the direction, you know? And it's like, the way that I've found two or three ways of getting around it, if you're good at meditation and can get immediately into it, great. My mind, however, is not always responsive to meditation. It likes the fact that I'm taking time to sit still because it has my full attention and it can talk more. You know. Now, Goldsmith, who is when he writes about meditation, says ignore it. And don't ever try and stop it. And most metaphysicians and prophets say that. Just let it talk. Because when it finds out you're not listening, it'll shut up. That's true. It only has, my mind only has the, this is, you love this. The mind only has the power that you give it. See, it needs me to agree with it before anything can transpire. You ever notice how it always says we? Huh? I think we should do this. I think you should do that. I think we should go here. We don't like that person. Or it'll say, I think you should. Now, all we had was the mind. If that's all there was to us, was the mind, it would not have to communicate with us. It would not need my cooperation. Who is it it's trying to convince to go along? What other part of my being is it talking to? Because if it was all by itself, we'd just go. Like an automaton. There would be no communication. None. But it's got to convince me. Ah, now it gets interesting. It's trying to convince the God quality in me. Because the God quality and the mind are not compatible when the mind is in control. And the mind can't stand it when God is in control, because the mind must have control. It's got to have control. I remember once I was talking to my therapist about something. I said, let me see, what exactly was it I said? Oh, I know. I was talking about a gal I had met, and I said something to her about it. I said, she's just not perfect enough, you know. I find a resistance in me, you know, she's just not perfect enough. And my therapist smiled and said, I think we've reached a point, she said, in the process here where we can no longer allow you to use the word perfect or perfection or perfectionism. Anytime you find yourself thinking in that word, you must substitute the word control. Yeah, it's a killer. I know. I felt the same way when I heard it. Because I really realized what she was saying. What I was saying about the girl I had met was not that she wasn't perfect, but that I couldn't control her. I'd met somebody I couldn't control, so therefore, you know, it's like that. And I'm talking about perfectionism myself. I'm talking about controlling me. Controlling me. You know? Well, there's an alternative for me controlling me is to let God control me. Not easy. Not easy. For me, it's not been easy. But the results have always been incredible. See? And an interesting thing about the compulsive, addictive personalities is this. We come in a program, and finally, at some point, in absolute, complete desperation, we are forced to pray, to surrender, to let go of something. Some situation becomes too much, and we let it go. And it works out fine. We let go, and it's resolved. Magically. God takes care of it. Works perfect. Okay? And the very next thing that comes up, we will not let go of. Now, isn't there an irony there in that? We who, when we found anything we liked, pursued it into the gates of insanity or death. If I found a specific drug that I liked, I would goddamn hold up stores to get it. Just to get that one specific... Wow, that felt great. I want more. And out come the guns and off to town we go, you know. And I want more. But I come here and I pray and the prayer is answered and the results are fine. And I turn right around and walk off like it never happened. And I have to drag myself one more time to the gates of insanity or death in recovery to let go of the next thing. You know? Instead of just letting go. I am of the school that we, when it comes to, here we go again. this one isn't as bad. I believe that we, based on my experience, my own experience, and a lot of other people that I know and a lot of stuff that I have read, I hang on with my body. I physically hang on to stuff, you know? And so anything I can do to make my body let go helps me let go on a spiritual level. And so if you're a tense person, of course I don't know who in the room isn't, but if you're one of these people who, you know, the neck and the shoulders and the, you know, you walk around like you're in a brace, you know. Hatha yoga is great. Just anything that forces you to start to stretch out, to start to let go. See, and the mind, by the way, will resist all this stuff. Because my experience has been anything that I do in the way of getting on a spiritual path, my mind resists because it represents a threat to its control. So I'm not saying you can just walk out of here and stroll into a yoga class saying, you know, I think I'll try a little yoga. Hi, I'm John, and here I am. If you get there by December, okay, you'll be doing great. Really great. You will have accomplished something because the resistance in you will be tremendous. And if you live in a non-supportive environment or move in a non-supportive environment, you have created around you a group of people who support your mind. Okay? And they will not help you either get there. You know? I know that's an uncomfortable one. I know it is. I don't mean to say these things, but... But it's, you know, God, I mean, we got to stop the stuff. Because we're the ones dying. You know, all the rest of these non-supportive people show up at the goddamn funeral and say, oh, poor John, geez, he's got cancer, 36 years old, can you believe that? He was tense all the time, though, of course, you know. Just didn't seem to be able to do anything about it. He never just could let go. You know? Right. Another trick of the mind is to never allow you to see your progress. It will absolutely refuse to validate your progression in recovery. It will always focus on what you should be doing, where you should be, or it will be comparing you to people who are 5 years ahead of you in the program, or 10. Or 20, wondering why, you know. I mean, your mind will sit there and say to you, how come you're not doing what I'm doing and you have 2 years and I have 24? What kind of jerk are you that you have not managed to accomplish all this in the last 24 months? Huh? A continuing failure, aren't you? But it's true. But it's dangerous. It's dangerous because it keeps you in a state of low self-esteem. And anxiety, you know, anxiety. I'm not enough. I can't do enough. Something's wrong with me. I'm not okay. I'm not, you know, and the mind is always there saying, yes, that's right. Why aren't you doing more? Why have you only lost 100 pounds? Why haven't you lost 2? How come you've only been abstinent for 6 months? You started 3 years ago. What kind of goddamn failure are you? Instead of seeing the successes and acknowledging them. And I'm going to give you a real trick, and the mind will strangle on this one. Look for the successes in others and walk up to them and acknowledge it. And you will so destroy the wiring in that part of your mind, eventually it will even be forced to see your success. And even in return from your coming up to these people, they may talk to you about your success. You ever notice how anybody comes to praise you, you can't stand it? Mm-hmm. God, you've been doing a great job, Sue. Oh, yeah, that's, well, you know. Instead of saying, yeah, right, thanks. You know? So do that. Look for people. Walk up to them
and acknowledge, you know, their progress. You look terrific. You've lost 10 pounds at least, or, you know, whatever it is. Now you look great. Or, you know, whatever. You make me feel good when you talk. I like your laugh. I like your smile. You know? I like whatever. One little thing. Because the trick is to get to the place where you look in the mirror and you say to the person in the mirror, I like your laugh. I like your smile. I like you. You know? And that's goddamn killer. Try it. Go home, look in the mirror, look yourself in the eyes, and tell yourself I love you. They used to tell me to do that in AA, and I'd goddamn die. I'd go home and stand in front of the mirror and be like... Oh, you're the sickest motherfucker I ever met. So much for that exercise and recovery. You know, and away I go. I couldn't say it. The words would not come up. I couldn't get them up. You know, today, man, I love it. I'll be bopping through town, you know, and passing a plate glass window somewhere in a store, and I'll catch a glimpse of me out of the corner of my eye, and I'll smile. Because I like the guy. He's just really a good guy. And I think part of it is the process of getting down to four voices. Because three of them are the adult, who is a beautiful person, an incredibly gentle man, with a staggering social consciousness, which I can't even believe myself. I mean, it moves me to tears. I never wanted to acknowledge it, because see, I'm not the kind of person who can see something and do nothing. I can't. I got to do something. And so now the social consciousness is starting to come up. And like I went last week, a couple people in New Mexico took me to a celebration at an Indian pueblo, and it was a feast day and a joyous day and a big celebration, see. And I watched this one specific group of dancers and I cried. It wasn't a happy day for me, because I could see the ravages of the disease of alcoholism and how it destroyed a people, you know, a whole fucking tribe, and it broke my heart, see.